Eurocontrol. Aviation Straight Talk. Live.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another Eurocontrol Aviation Straight Talk Live. I'm Andrew Charlton. Thanks for being with us. I hope that you find the upcoming conversation we're having today to be as interesting as I'm sure I will find it, because it's an area I don't know dreadfully well, which is to say the area of engine manufacturing rather than some of the more usual parts of aviation, well, perfectly usual, but some of the more better examined parts of the aviation industry. And today we're talking to Mr. John Slattery, who is the CEO at GE Engines. And of course, GE is in turn a joint venture partner with Safran in CFM. Something like 70% of the world's engines are powered by GE, and so it should be an absolutely fascinating conversation. So, John, we've just heard from Eamon about your exciting news about CFM Rise technology. Tell us more about that. What's behind that?
Well, Andrew, we at GE Aviation, we've just finished our, if you like, our renewal of our commercial engine portfolio. So the LEAP, the GE-NX, and of course the GE-9X, which powers the big 777X. And now as we look forward, you know, the challenge that is tasked on us to address is that carbon emission goal by 2050 to half carbon emissions. And to do that, we need to now step up again and invent the future of flight and working with our airframer partners. So that's the noble cause, if you like. That's the mission that we want to rally around here at GE Aviation. So with the launch of the RISE program that we announced last week in Paris, of course, the home of the Climate Accord, we announced RISE, which stands for Revolutionary Innovation for Sustainable Engines. It's a development program that we will look at over 300 different technologies that we will develop. Eventually, that will manifest into an engine that will enter into service sometime in the mid-2030s. But a lot of those technologies, Andrew, that we will be developing through the RISE program will probably end up feathering a lot of those technologies into our current engines and even engines that we may even introduce before the mid-2030s. So this is GE Aviation stepping up to reduce the fuel burn. The fuel burn target, by the way, is 20%. It is the biggest single target jump in fuel burn reduction that we've ever undertaken at GE Aviation, and of course with Safran, because this is the RISE program is a CFM international initiative. But you know, Andrew, what people get confused about is the difference between CO2 emissions and the fuel burn. If we can change the kind of fuel, maybe we'll talk about it here, if we can change the type of fuel that goes into the engine, well, we can reduce those emissions a lot more than the initial 20% we're talking about.
So the 20% is just the technological advance, if you like. And that comes, two questions come out of that, I think. The first one is, the history of engines has been constant improvement and constant benefits and so forth, even though, as you say, 20% is the largest single leap we've ever seen. But is there an end point? I mean, leave aside the fuel for a moment. I mean, eventually we can't find any more, can we? I mean, it must be like athletics records. You know, it must take some time to travel the distance.
Yeah, look, it's a great point. But let's just frame up what the 20% means first in terms of the fuel burn, whatever fuel you put onto the aircraft. If you were to apply that onto our narrowbody fleet today, that would be the equivalent, Andrew, of taking 17 million cars off the road. But with the RISE program, we're going to have an engine. It'll be a hybrid electric engine, open fan, but it will have the capability to burn up to 100% sustainable aviation fuel. And Andrew, it'll have the capability to burn hydrogen. Uh-huh. If you had enough SAF, and we could probably talk about that.
We need to talk about that, yeah.
You could reduce the CO2 by 80%. And the real nirvana, of course, is burning hydrogen. If you got to burning green hydrogen, you'd be reducing your CO2 emissions by 100%.
And then I read the other day, then your emission there is water, which you could then recycle inside the aeroplane.
That's correct.
Yeah, because apparently water at high altitudes isn't real good anyway. But if we can recycle it back inside the aeroplane, then that is nirvana, isn't it? That's almost perpetual motion.
almost perpetual motion. And look, a lot of work to go from here to industrializing a hydrogen burning engine. But the actual physics, the science, from the engine's perspective of burning hydrogen, that's very doable. We can see a clear technology path to doing that. And in fact, in our gas power business, we have over 4 million hours of learning around burning hydrogen already. Wow. In our turbines. But we got a lot of work to do there, Andrew, with the we're going to need policymakers and governments to come together. The whole ecostructure needs to come together for hydrogen to make it viable, but also for sustainable aviation fuels. That's clearly the first step to meaningfully reduce our carbon emissions.
I'm interested that you've twice now mentioned that this, if we work hard enough and if we're good, this engine will, the RISE engine, boys up in acronyms must have had a great time getting RISE to work too, by the way. We'll get it to burning 100% SAFs. Yeah. I had been under the impression that given that SAFs are simply a drop-in, that was always part of the game. But is there something extra to only have SAFs? Is that something different for the engines?
So right now, today, with every engine that we produce at GE Aviation, and indeed Safran with the CFM, but even our wide-body engines, the NX and the 9X, they're all certified to operate with a blend of up to 50% SAF today. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, that's with no hardware modification whatsoever on the engine. Right now, we're working with regulators around the world to define what the standard is, the definition and the standard of what defines 100% SAF. Mm. When we get to agreeing that standard, there will be some small hardware modifications required on the engine, but actually nothing meaningful. Some works with the tubes and the ducts. The viscosity of SAF is different to the properties of kerosene, K1, but very doable. The big issue is getting availability of SAF. I mean, right now, the airlines around the world, I think it's something like 0.1%.
I think it's less than that, but yeah.
And if Carsten Spohr or Ben Smith were to fly SAF on Lufthansa or the Air France KLM fleet, they would burn the world's SAF in one day. Mm. So the challenge on us, the challenge on us is to create a stable demand so that industry can rally around and create the availability of SAF so that airlines can then get it at a more economical price and can get it at the airports in a user-friendly fashion.
You don't think that demand's already there?
The demand, I mean, it's it could be a debate around the carrot and the stick. If I talk to every airline CEO around the world, they want to do everything that they can to share in the target, the noble cause, the mission of reducing their CO2 emissions. They want to do that because it's good business. That's what they're hearing from their passengers. So the hurdle that they have to get over is, number one, the economics of SAF. It's expensive today because the supply is limited. But the demand is there. Now, we do need an eco-structure to make it more user-friendly to get SAF to the airports, to actually generate SAF, to distill and refine SAF. We feel comfortable that it is all doable. Certainly, the refining part of it is very doable. Frankly, with the current footprint of refineries that are out there today refining oil, can very easily move over to SAF. Mm. But Andrew, what's missing in the middle, and my reference earlier to the carrot and the stick, I know the airlines want to do it because they want to serve their customers, and the customers want to do it today, and increasingly we want to do it in the future. But the regulators, the policymakers, they may need to play a role here. And as they look around encouraging incentives to help people generate SAF, and their SAF can come from a multitude of sources, including synthetic SAFs. And also, if we bring up the supply, the price will come down. That supply-demand equation will help bring the price down. But regulators are also looking at potentially regulating the percentage of SAF that would need to be used on board an aircraft. So that's the stick, if you like. I think people want to do it anyway. It's the right thing to do. And I believe, Andrew, in the years ahead, this is all going to come together. I think everybody right across the ecostructure believes in this noble cause of reducing CO2 emissions. Mm. I think collectively the industry will get there. SAF will be our first step, and then ultimately to hydrogen.
Right. It's sort of a funny role for an engine maker to be concerned about the fuel that propels the engines, isn't it? I mean, in the history of GE, were you ever interested in being so well informed about, I don't know, drilling for oil and distillation and all those sorts of things? Is this just part of the new world that we're living in?
There's no doubt we're in a new world. And I think, COVID has accelerated everything.
Yeah.
Right across the board. We will do our part, and we're stepping up with our partners at Safran, as I mentioned earlier, to go for the biggest single movement in commitment of CO2 reduction, of fuel burn reduction of at least 20%. Mm. So we're going to do what we can from the science in the engine, the propulsive efficiency to bring it to the maximum we can bring it to, and the current technologies and the new technologies we can develop, and the thermal efficiencies right in the middle of the engine. But it is true, Andrew. Right now, to get to that nirvana of carbon-free emission, zero carbon-free flight, we're going to need to have improved fuels. We're going to need to have sustainable aviation fuels in a volume that will make sense for the operators around the world. And then we need to stay on that path to get to ultimately to find a way to burn green hydrogen. That's where we got to go. Because look, Andrew, the traveling public, you're seeing it in Northern Europe and Southern Europe, Central Europe today. Increasingly, that narrative is here in North America. We're seeing it in Southeast Asia. The travelers of the future, the passengers who we are all here ultimately to serve, they want to know what their carbon emission per mile is going to be in the future, yeah. Whether they want to be taxed for it or whether they just want to know that they're not hurting the planet. We want to play our role in that. So this is a point of inflection for our industry, we believe, and we want to play our role in inventing the future of flight.
Right. You said earlier, I think, you see SAFs as sort of the staging posts, but getting to hydrogen is the end game. Is there a role for electric motors and things like that as well?
Yeah, just go back to the first half of that. We certainly see SAF playing a meaningful role, you know, in the 30s and indeed into the 40s. It's kind of like the parallel is, you know, at GE, we're coming out of the coal business. We're in the clean gas business as a transfer fuel right now, until ultimately, you know, that business may well get into hydrogen. They've already started, as I mentioned earlier, with over 4 million hours of experience. But as we think about SAF and hydrogen, we have to have a path to get to hydrogen. Mm. I think SAF will prove the bridge. That bridge may last for, you know, 15 or 20 years, but the engine will be enabled. To burn hydrogen. And to your point, Andrew, it will be a hybrid electric engine. So we will have a full hybrid electric capability on the engine that will mature from the RISE technology development program.
Right, right. Well, I mean, just as well, really, given that you've got electric in your name, I'd be heartbroken if there wasn't something electric about it. Before we move on, and there's lots still to talk about, but I'm really fascinated that before you were at GE, of course, you were at Bombardier. No, you weren't. I beg your pardon. You were at Embraer. Whoops, that was Freudian, wasn't it? You were at Embraer. I'll get it if it kills me.
That's right.
And the manufacturing industry is incredibly competitive and incredibly, aggressive, if you like. But yet over on the engine side of the house, you've got a joint venture with one of your competitors. What difference do you see between engine manufacturer on the one hand and the mainframe manufacturer on the other?
So, you know, at Embraer, And generally on the airframe side, the focus is on, you know, building the best new aircraft you can and delivering them to the customers. Of course, we share that philosophy here at the new installed technology side on the engines. However, a huge part of our backlog, which is over $250 billion today at GE Aviation, a huge part of that is our services business. So we're literally tied into serving our customers in many instances for decades to come. So it's not just about delivering that new engine with the new aircraft on day one. Our business is very much tied to servicing and supporting the airlines as those engines come up for shop visits and doing those turnaround times very quickly, supporting our open architecture, our open source platforms that we have around the world. We have many, many MROs around the world that independently support the overhaul of the GE engines and, of course, the CFM. But that's the single biggest difference between my experience as almost 10 years as an airframer and now on the engine side.
Do you find on the engine side you spend more time talking to the mainframers on whose wings you're going to stick the engines, or to the customers, airlines themselves?
You know, in the first instance, when you are developing new technologies, you then think about your customers as the airframers. Those are truly our partners as we together invent the future of flight. So constant engagement to ensure that the collective of the airframe and the engine integration generates the best possible operating economics and operating performance for the airlines. As you go through the cadence of entering into service then a new aircraft with the new engine combination, then you're focused on engaging with the airlines. And that becomes a major focus. But in reality, in my seat, I probably spend, you know, a third of my time, maybe even a half of my time talking to the airframers, and the balance talking to the airline operators around the world, if you just think about those two customers. The lessors, a very big constituent, of course, that are a lot are headquartered in Europe and in my beloved Ireland, play a key part of our eco-structure as well. So I spend a lot of time, you know, engaging and listening to our customers. So, you know, we're listening to our MRO partners around the world. We're listening to the lessors who are providing the liquidity, the aerospace banks who are providing the liquidity. But ultimately, it's the operator and indeed the passenger. Increasingly, we like to hear what the passengers are thinking about. When we think about the RISE technology program and the innovations where we want to push the boundaries to really go after that nirvana of zero emissions, That drive, that commitment, that's coming actually from the true customer at the end of the day, who is the passenger. Mm-hmm. So you're listening to everybody right across the ecosystem. And what's interesting now, Andrew, is as we think about the fuels, the sustainable aviation fuels, and as you think about hydrogen, we're even broadening the aperture of those counterparts that we're talking to, that we're engaging with, that we're listening to, trying to, you know, ensure that we're part of the narrative and that we're there ultimately to serve our airframer partners and, of course, our airline customers right around the world.
Right. You mentioned Ireland. Is there something in Guinness that makes the Irish the world's leading aviation staff providing shop? Is there, what's the...
Well, I think that question could be just as well posed to the Director General.
Well, indeed, he's but one of the many Irish folk I have interviewed in Straight Talks.
Or his right hand, Donal, who we had the opportunity to spend a little time with earlier. You know, I guess it goes back to Ireland is an island nation. The Irish love to travel. We had, you know, if you go back to the 70s, of course, Dr. Tony Ryan, who came out of Aer Lingus, a lot of people don't know that.
Indeed.
And started trying to place some excess 747s and spawned what has become a, you know, just an amazing eco-structure. You know, I think the Irish headquartered leasing companies, you know, own a massive percentage of the world's leased fleet today, our headquarters there, but also Ryanair, Aer Lingus. But in the earlier days, the Aer Lingus management team had a philosophy of going out and supporting other management teams in the Middle East and in Africa, and that just kind of got us out there. So we're travelers. We like to be on the road. We like to be with people, telling our stories and listening, having a little fun. And, you know, being an island nation, travel was in an airplane was just the best possible way. I'm super proud. We were talking before we came on air about, you know, Alan Joyce all the way down in Sydney in Australia. And, you know, I'm super proud of all of the airlines that have some lineage back to Ireland. And it goes way beyond just, of course, Ryanair and Aer Lingus. But I'm part to be proud of the broader ecosystem.
Were you part of Aer Lingus, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I wasn't. Unfortunately not. It's the only part of the ecostructure I haven't actually participated in yet. So I've been an aircraft lessor, an aerospace banker, an airframe manufacturer, an engine manufacturer. But I can tell you, Andrew, I have real awe, you know, when I get with our airline customers, because they take the risk every single day. The black swans show up for our airline customers every single day. And I really am in awe when I meet and spend time with our airline customers and listen to the challenges that they have to deal with. But that's the only part of the ecosystem that I really haven't spent time working in. I did spend a lot of time with Varig Airlines down in Brazil right at the start of my aviation career in the mid-90s, working with very closely with Fernando Pinto, who was the CEO back then. Learned a lot. In fact, one of my very first deals was working with Varig as they were negotiating their engine maintenance cost, our agreement with GE Aviation. So it's a circular world in so many ways.
Well, indeed. It also proof, of course, that you don't have to work in an airline to work in aviation. And a lesson that I think a number of people could probably take away, very frankly. You mentioned, you previously talked about one can't not talk about the pandemic. Has it had an impact on your orders?
Yeah, I mean, it's had a massive impact on our orders. Of course, it was exaggerated by the unfortunate grounding of the MAX incident or the MAX grounding because of the two terrible incidents. But that coupled with COVID and the pandemic had a very meaningful impact on our orders. On the upside, Andrew, when you look at the momentum that we've achieved in the last number of months, you know, the MAX deal at Southwest, the MAX deal at Alaska, the A320neo deal, the largest single deal we've ever done at GE Aviation through CFM at Indigo on the Neo with the LEAP 1A. We're seeing a lot of momentum, and I think I had the opportunity to spend some time with Guillaume down in Airbus last week, 10 days ago. I talk to Boeing, obviously, on a regular basis. They can feel the momentum coming back. And the one thing that we are, and I'm spending a lot of my time on today, is preparing for that ramp. I can tell you it is almost a daily conversation that I have with my chairman, Larry Culp, is to ensure that our organization is ready to serve on our two customers. You asked about the customers earlier. Mm. So the two constituent customers we need to serve, of course, as the surge of activity really starts to manifest here in the second half of this year and into next year, those shop visits, we need to be ready to address those as they're happening. And then, of course, as the ramp up of new aircraft has been signaled by both Boeing and Airbus, we need to be ready to work with those customers for the new installs. We did take out a serious and very painful actions to take out a serious percentage of our workforce. But Andrew, we did that when we were going through those decisions, very mindful of the need to be ready for the inevitable surge when it materializes. And as I travel around the US, you know, we see the capacity that's now back in the United States. You see the capacity that's back in the Chinese market, almost at pre-COVID levels. The United States is approaching, you know, the high 80s relative to pre-COVID levels. Europe, of course, is still 50% down. But Andrew, you'll know firsthand, that's a massive improvement just in the last 4 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it's coming. People want to travel. And as Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta, said last week, you know, he's already starting to see the business travelers coming back. In fact, Ed said he expected the business travelers, certainly at least domestically, to be at pre-COVID levels after July 4th. So it's coming. We need to make sure that we're ready to support our partners.
But at the moment, what we seem to have is regional Europe, regional US, regional Australia, although they managed to keep shutting it down from time to time for the heck of it. What we're not, regional China, what we're not seeing is the long haul stuff.
Yeah.
And America, you know, the US back to 80%, Europe back to 50%, all great news. But the other thing that's mix that with the fact that we seem to have seen a lot of the airlines slim down their fleets, both in terms of the numbers of aircraft, but also the size of the aircraft. Do you think that trend will continue, or do you think if suddenly we will resuscitate our A380s and all those sorts of things?
Well, look, let's go back to the first half of that question. There's no question the long haul international travel is going to lag the narrow body activity. We see narrow body activity, you know, the 73s, the A320s, getting back to pre-COVID levels sometime early in 2023.
Wow. Mm.
And the wide body activity will probably pragmatically lag about 12 months. And, you know, Andrew, I really want to commend Willie Walsh, another great Irishman, of course.
Indeed.
And, I really want to commend Willie's leadership over at IATA in driving the, you know, the initiatives that we have to get the digital passports for COVID and vaccines. People, you know, can move through airports that won't have to quarantine. They won't have that concern. As we saw firsthand through COVID, if you travel a long distance, you could kind of get, quote unquote, caught. Many, many miles from home, many thousands of miles from home. So we need to take that fear away. That's probably going to take a little bit longer than the narrow bodies returning. I mean, I really think the narrow body activity will be in a very strong place towards the back end of 22. But we're estimating early in 23, it'll be back to pre-COVID levels and maybe 12 months later for the wide body activity. In terms of the second half of your question, which is, you know, the 380s, and that size aircraft. Well, look, I think it's too early to tell, Andrew. Business models, one of the great thing about our business is, you know, the models evolve. I mean, if you go back 20 years, 25 years ago, you know, the Ryanairs and Southwests were kind of an anomaly, that low-cost carrier model. And today, of course, we have successful LCCs right around the world. So as we look forward, one of the more exciting things about our business is the capabilities from the competitive dynamic of those leaders of these airlines to evolve. As Darwin said, Andrew, you know, it's not the smartest or the fittest or the strongest that survive after he visited the Galapagos, right? Mm. It's those that evolve best to the changing environment.
Indeed.
So I have full confidence that, you know, the airline leaders around the world and their boards of directors are trying to figure out what those future models will be. Whatever those models will be, I want to make sure that GE Aviation continue to be there to support them. Today we support about 70% of the world's fleet. I want to make sure that we're there to continue to support the airlines, whatever way, whatever size aircraft they elect to fly in the future.
So part of what I think we're watching, although I agree it's early days, even if airlines are getting slimmed down aircraft, smaller aircraft, they're also pushing for longer haul small aircraft, if you like, the A321LR, even the 787. That's good news for engine manufacturers, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is changing. It is evolving. You know, the MAX 10, the A321 are both being used in lieu of, you know, smaller wide body aircraft. But again, our position, Andrew, here is just to make sure we're here to serve the airframer partners. We're here to serve the airline partners. It's really up to those constituents to decide what the business model is and how they're ultimately going to serve their customer. Once they figure that out, our job is to make sure that they have, you know, the most efficient lift under their wings. So we've got great penetration, almost 40,000 engines on the commercial side of our business alone, flying around the world that are being supported. I want to get back to a stage where we can continue now to grow that net franchise footprint that we have. I want to see new operators coming in. I want that competitive dynamic to continue to grow because, you know, Andrew, there's no, in my experience, there has been no singularly more powerful force for bringing people together, bringing communities together, joining ideas, and generating commerce that benefits everyone than the airline industry. I saw it firsthand in my beloved Brazil when I was down there. And, you know, shout out to David Neilman with the launch of Azul, now run by John Rogerson down there. But, you know, a lot of the folks that are flying on the originally, of course, on the GE-powered 190s and 195s, and, of course, now the GE-powered A320neos that they have. But a lot of those folks, Andrew, were originally taking four-day journeys on buses. And now they're taking a two-hour flight at the same cost or maybe even cheaper. So I've seen firsthand, you've seen it in China, not only just opening up the eastern seaboard, but opening up northern and western China. Of course, we've all seen it firsthand in Europe and the benefits of bringing communities together. So it's important. And that's why, Andrew, at the start of our conversation, we spoke about RISE. We spoke about technology driving the lower CO2 emissions. That's critically important. We're at an inflection point in our industry. We need to win the right to continue to grow. And that's going to be rooted, in my humble opinion, in our commitment to drive down CO2 emissions.
I couldn't agree with that more, of course, but I'm interested in two things, I think, out of that. One is, you said you spent a bit of time talking to regulators. As a general comment, historically, that wouldn't have been one of your normal beats, would it, to go and talk to regulators, or is that not true?
No, it would have been, certainly at Embraer, as we're certifying new aircraft. I was there for the writing of the business case for the E2. So I brought that through the process of the business case right through to certification and entry into service. So we're fully engaged and we entered that into service with the Brazilian authority and, of course, the FAA and EASA. So all three authorities on one day. And as we're entering the aircraft into new jurisdictions around the world, whether it's getting, certification with CAAC in China or other authorities. So fully engaged with the regulators. And that's a good place to be fully aligned, very transparent. So it is something that I did in my world at Embraer, not so much before that, the airspace leasing and the airspace banking side, but certainly as an airframer and definitely now as an engine manufacturer, very close with the FAA and supportive, of course, of Boeing in their engagements, but also our own bilateral engagements with the FAA and EASA, of course.
But the FAA and EASA is, if you like, on the safety side and the certification side, whereas certainly in Europe, the SAFs thing is being run through the European Commission itself, not that EASA isn't, but you know what I mean, and it's very much a political game as to the mandate and how quickly and what sort of numbers. I mean, you're less familiar with the halls of the Department of Transport as you are with the FAA, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. Is that true?
Not as true as you frame it out. Certainly, since I've joined GE Aviation, I have regular engagements with members of the Commission, speaking exactly about our commitment to sustainable aviation fuels. Of course, Andrew, we have a big footprint in Europe as well. With Avio Aero, our additive business. So we many, many thousands of engineers right across Europe, not only in Italy, but right across Europe. So we're fully engaged and I speak regularly with members of the Commission as we explain to the Commission our commitment to sustainable aviation fuel and to the clean initiatives that that the EU has been certainly a unique global driver of. I also had that same conversation with the regulatory authorities here in the United States, as they also are committed to driving the a clean initiative here in the US. So it's definitely part of the day job.
Oh, okay. I beg your pardon. My second sort of weird question at one level is, as we move to electric motor cars, Tesla literally came out of nowhere. And at one level, it seems Tesla had an easier job than the other car manufacturers, because all he'd had to do was put wheels on a computer, yeah. Whereas the other car manufacturers had to put a computer inside their car. Is there another Tesla out there in the engine area, do you think, that could? I realise that's a stupid question. Do you predict something unpredictable? But we've got to remember, John, coming from Australia, I don't think black swans are unusual at all.
Yeah. there may well be. There may well be another Tesla out there. I've come from an environment, and I'm now at an environment where, you know, we encourage competition. And, you know, when we announced the RISE program, I think it was Tim Heifer over at Reuters asked, hey, what do you think the view of Rolls-Royce and Pratt & Whitney is around the announcements that you're making today? And I went ahead and said, look, we welcome competition, and I would encourage Rolls-Royce and Pratt & Whitney, bring their best technologies to the table and let's compete. Because ultimately, our customers will be the winners and the planet will be a winner. And by the way, a couple of days later, Warren East did come out and say that they wanted to compete on that front. And we welcome that competition, because competition forces us to listen and pay more attention, to be more humble, to be better at our processes of even production, and really drive those lean processes that we have across our organization. But there may well be somebody out there that's coming up with something that we haven't thought about today. And, you know, we would encourage those that have ideas to come and share them with us. We have our Global Resource Center at GE. I think it's roughly 750 PhDs all working together, trying to figure out the future. And as Thomas Edison once said, you know, he said his job, the founder of GE, his job was to listen to what people want and then go and invent it. So I would encourage, folks that have ideas and they want the industrialization capabilities and the innovation DNA that we have at GE to work with them and develop new technologies. So I'm very encouraging of people that have ideas to come and engage with us. If they don't want to come and engage with us and want to compete with us, it'll just force us to get better. So is there another Tesla out there? Is there another new type of engine out there? There may well be. But when it comes to open fan architecture, when it comes to hybrid electric, when it comes to the innovations that we have on materials, on that the core, those thermal efficiencies that we're driving, when it comes to our track record on delivering that and doing it safely, and we think about SQDC here at GE Aviation, right across GE, actually under Larry's leadership, that stands for safety, quality, delivery, and cost, and they're in that order. Safety is number one, so always delivering with safety at the forefront of your mind. Over 37,000 engines on the commercial side, and, you know, and not dissimilar, maybe a little smaller number on the military side. So doing that safely and bringing our passengers home every day, that's our mandate. So we're committed. We're committed to innovation. We have been for over 100 years. But Andrew, there's no escaping. We are at a point of inflection. We really need to push beyond our commitment to reduce, targeting at least 20% reduction in the fuel burn, but targeting a CO2 reduction of 80 to 100%. We believe that's core part of the DNA of inventing the future of flight.
Am I right in thinking that open fan engines are quieter as well? Is that something
Well, they're not going to be. Our open fan was, so it's a single stage open fan rotor, will not be any louder than the LEAP that we have today. So those decibels in the cabin are not going to be any louder. It's also not going to be any slower than the LEAP engine today. So the customer is going to have a very similar experience, except when the customer looks at whatever it'll be, Andrew, by the mid-2030s, it won't, for sure, there'll be no paper tickets. They'll be looking at whatever the equivalent of the iPhone is then, and they'll be able to tell what their CO2 emission was for that flight. That's what the customers are going to be focused on. They'll go, will be able to go as fast as they did. It won't be any louder in the cabin, but the CO2 emission is going to be a fraction of what it is today. I think that's what the customers are going to be focused on.
So what about supersonic? You've talked about faster. Do you think there's anything, there's a lot of talk about supersonic at the moment. Is there any future in that?
Look, again, time will tell. We're flying our engines at Mach 0.8, Mach 0.82, almost at the speed of sound. Obviously, you have a choice that's out there for entry into service sometime, I guess, next decade as well. But our focus right now is that, you know, if you want to be good, you want to focus on, you know, what's the niche that you're on. Our niche is focusing on, you know, the larger commercial aircraft that are going to fly, you know, with 100 passengers all the way up to, you know, the 777X or beyond in the future. That's going to be our focus. So it's for others really to comment on whether the supersonics will have a real business case. And at the end of the day, Andrew, you know, for us and for me, when I'm bringing forward an initiative, I have to bring it to the chairman and the board and present the business case, the economics around the long-term return for our shareholders. So I did listen to one of the recent casts that you had when you asked Willie Walsh that same question. So
he was fairly categorical, wasn't he?
but look, time will tell. But our focus right now will be on the RISE program. Our focus will be on the successful entry into service of the 9X. Our focus is on, you know, supporting that re-entry into service of the MAX. Our focus is on supporting the NX, and of course that huge incumbent CFM56 fleet that we have right around the world. In addition to our military business, so we've a lot to take care of already with what we have on our plate.
Indeed, and that's a perfect segue to my final question, which I ask all of our guests, which is, what more do you think Eurocontrol can do to help facilitate aviation?
You know, it's a great question. I think the first thing I would do here is applaud Eamon Brennan's leadership at Eurocontrol. I mean, you know, it's at times of crisis that real leaders stand up. And Eamon has been a stalwart that people have looked to as we've gone through this crisis. Eamon's embracing, his philosophy of embracing transparency and communication, an example of which we're doing right now, constant communication with his customers, sharing with people transparently what's going on with the daily departures for every region, working with all the OEMs and other constituent members in the ecostructure to share their forecasts of where they're seeing the recovery, because we all need to plan and you know, plan our capital according to how we see the return of the market. And of course, Eamon's ability and Eurocontrol's ability to work closely with the Commission, share with the Commission and encourage the Commission on the journey the Commission is already on, which is on sustainability. So I applaud Eurocontrol. I congratulate my friend Eamon Brennan again for the amazing work he and his team and Donal, his right hand. You know, we're lucky to have an organization in Europe as robust as Eurocontrol.
Well, thanks very much, John. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you found that as interesting as I did. I have to confess, I know perhaps less about engines than some other parts of the industry, and I found that absolutely fantastic. So all I can do, John, on behalf of everyone, I'm sure, is say thank you to you again. And I look forward to seeing everyone else again very soon. Thanks very much.
This episode is from our Aviation Straight Talk Live series, bringing you exclusive insights from aviation leaders across the world.